What is higher education good for? A professor looks at how the answer to that question has changed throughout American history. Recently, there has been a lot of attention focused on the cost-benefit analysis, or the value of college, whether the high price tag of getting a higher education is worth it. And that is a valuable question. But there is an even larger question for our society. What is the value of higher education to our country, our communities? The founders of early colleges and universities in America espoused civic-mindedness and the common good. They hoped their graduates would lead their states and communities and make the young nation a better place. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we discuss the evolution of higher education with Charles Dorn, a Bowdoin College professor whose new book is titled For the Common Good, A New History of Higher Education in America. Maine Calling is next, but first this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Students are back at college for the fall semester, but why are they there? Is it to get a good-paying job upon graduation, or is it to become better citizens of the world? Or both? The value and meaning of a college education means different things to different people, and it has evolved over the years. That is the topic of a new book, and joining me in the studio is the author of that book, Charles Dorn. He's Associate Dean for Academic Affairs and Professor of Education at Bowdoin College. He's the author of American Education, Democracy, and the Second World War, and his new book is called For the Common Good, A New History of Higher Education in America. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you see colleges as serving a greater purpose beyond educating young minds? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome, Professor Dorn, to the studio.
Thanks, Jennifer. Thanks for having me.
I think that it's really interesting how you came to this topic. Your interest in higher education isn't just academic, is it? And I was wondering if you'd mind telling us a little bit about your background, how you became interested in the impact of higher ed and the history of it.
Sure. Yeah. So I had an interesting experience myself in higher education. So neither of my parents went to college. My dad dropped out of high school in order to join the Navy during World War II. And my mom graduated from high school, but then went into the workforce. And but nevertheless, they decided that their sons were going to go to college. And as my mother often said, we want you to be able to work with your head instead of your hands. This was the phrase that she used. And so for her, higher education was a very utilitarian thing. You went to college so that you could get a good job later on. And of course, she was right about that. What's one of the purposes of higher education? But in terms of my own personal experience, once I got to college, what I found is that there are lots of other things that were happening to students while they were at college. And that certainly was my experience. And so over time, once I graduated from college myself, became a high school teacher, went back to graduate school, got a PhD, and became a historian, I began wondering about the ways in which higher education has played multiple roles, certainly this occupational or vocational role, but other roles in people's lives. And that's what sort of took me to the question of how higher education has made other kinds of contributions.
And it's so interesting that your parents said, as many parents did, this is so you can work with your head and not your hands, because they also didn't devalue working with your hands. I mean, they saw that as something noble. And so it's interesting to me that they didn't want that for their son.
Right. No, so it's a really great question, right? So my parents have lived very, very vibrant, rich lives, and they did that without the benefit of a college education. So, you know, I find myself in this interesting position where I have to ask, what really is the value of a higher education if I know that people can live meaningful lives without it? And my parents certainly were aware of that as well. It's not as if they thought if we didn't graduate from college, that we'd be failures or something. But they were acutely aware of the ways in which higher education contributes to one's preparation for the workforce. And they wanted us, my brother and I, to have opportunities. And one of those opportunities was to engage in work that, again, sort of my mother would describe as, you know, working with your head. So teaching for in my situation was a good example of that. So no, you're right. They certainly didn't devalue working with their hands, but they wanted greater opportunities for their sons to choose from.
So these days, the dominant conversation about higher ed seems to be, is college worth the cost? In other words, is it a good investment for the individual student as far as career potential? But you say early American colleges and universities were asking a different question. They were asking more about the common good, not the individual benefit.
Right. So this is one of the interesting elements of higher education history in the United States, and that is that if you go to any college or university website today and you track down the sort of mission statement, if you will, you'll probably find something in there about promoting the common good or the public welfare or the public good in some form or another. We can go back to the early national period, the late 18th century, the early 19th century, and see almost the same language being used in terms of the purpose of the institutions. So my home institution of Bowdoin College has a profound commitment to the public good. What was originally described by Bowdoin's first president in his inaugural address as a commitment to the common good. But that wasn't specific to Bowdoin at the time. If you take a look at higher education founding legislation or charter statements at the time, you'll see very, very similar sorts of claims. So this tradition of higher education in America contributing to the common good is a really long-standing one. And it is with us still today. But it might be defined in different terms than it has been historically. But it really is in some ways a profoundly important element of American higher education that if we want to understand colleges and universities today, we really have to understand this sort of public service component that has been with us for over two centuries.
It may be in the mission statement, but when one is a parent of a teenager looking at colleges, there is no statistic out there which college best contributes to the common good. There are statistics about the average earnings for graduates, the average SAT scores, how difficult, how selective it is to get into that college. But there really isn't a measure. It seems as though it's less important.
It does seem that way for sure. And so these were really the questions that motivated the project that resulted in this book. Because once you look back in time and you look at in the archives of the colleges and the universities that were founded early in the nation's history and you see these claims to promote the common good, then the obvious next question is, okay, how did that work exactly? How was that operationalized? Was it just the founders who knew about this claim? Did the students know anything about it? And how did that work? And really, so those were the questions that drove me to do the research. One of the things that I discovered in doing that research is that not only were there concerns about how colleges and universities contributed to society for 200 years, but there were these recurring questions that happened to be in the headlines today. And this has to do with college access, who gets into college and where. It has to do with affordability, certainly the cost and how much it costs to go to college, and is that investment worth it? You sort of get the payback on that. And the other big topic was what we might call sort of curricular relevance, right? Does what you learn at college have absolutely anything to do with what you do later on in your life? Those are questions that are front and center for us today in discussions about higher education, but they've actually been with us for 200 years. There's nothing new in any of those questions. They might have been manifested in slightly different ways, but you see those debates recurring throughout time in the history of American higher education.
It's interesting, the admission to Bowdoin and University of South Carolina that you profile in your book, both of these young men, of course, were expected to read Greek and Latin.
Right, right. That's right.
So for admission.
That's right, yeah. So early in the nation's history, the admissions exam, if you will, had to do with some degree of fluency in Latin and Greek. And that had largely to do with the fact that the curriculum at college was a classical curriculum. What you studied were the classics. And that determined sort of who got in and who didn't. Now, in order to receive a proper education in Latin and Greek, you really needed to have some sort of a tutor, and that often entailed some sort of private tutoring, and that costs something. And so there was an element to which social class played into who would be admitted to colleges early in the nation's history. And you know, that was at the time considered one of the ways that you would cultivate virtue amongst young men, is that you would foster mental discipline. And the way to do that is to get those young men really to exercise their minds. The mind was thought of as a muscle, and you had to exercise it. And the way to exercise it was by memorizing and reciting in Latin and Greek. And that was the sort of pedagogical model that was with us for a long time in the nation's history.
You know, what's interesting to me is that we talk about higher education as though it's one thing, one megalith. The way you have outlined your book, the chapters in your book, reminds us that it's really many, many different things with roots, different kinds of schools had very different missions in the beginning.
No, that's right. You know, we use this term higher education today, and we actually think we mean something by it. but the truth is that really what we're talking about when we use the term is the hodgepodge of institutional types and kinds that have developed over the years. When you think about the kinds of institutions that exist today, we have two-year and four-year colleges, we have research universities, we have women's colleges, we have military academies, we have community colleges, and the list sort of goes on and on and on. So we use the term higher education, but really, what are we talking about? A good example might be in the present day is that if you take the student bodies of the top 50 colleges and the top 50 universities in the United States, you get about 350,000 students. And that sounds like a lot until you take a look at the student population of the nation's community colleges, which is somewhere around 12 million. So if we were actually thinking of students when we use the term higher education today, we should all immediately think community colleges because that's where the students are. But of course, that's not the case. Oftentimes when people use the term higher education today, if they went to college, they're thinking of their own experience. And so it is, you're right, it is this sort of collection of institutions. But one of the things that I found interesting in the research for the book was that in many ways, this collection of different kinds of institutions is a product of reforms that occurred over time. So early in the nation's history, you had colleges like Bowdoin College, Georgetown College, which is present-day Georgetown University, South Carolina College, present-day University of South Carolina. And they provided, as you identified, a particular curriculum in a particular context for a particular demographic of student. Over time, people became really impatient with that, that was not meeting the needs of a whole bunch of other people who wanted access to higher education. And so there were two approaches to solving that problem. One was to pressure the older institutions to change, which they did slowly over time. The other approach was just to create entirely new institutions. And that's what happened. And so, for instance, in the during what I call the antebellum period, prior to the Civil War in the nation's history, we see new kinds of colleges being created in the United States. The Agricultural College of the State of Michigan, which is today Michigan State University, was a brand new kind of institution in America, an agricultural college that taught something called agricultural sciences. So there goes the Latin and Greek. And in fact, Latin and Greek were not admissions requirements for that kind of place. Another kind of institution was what was called the normal school. And those were borrowed from, this was an idea that was borrowed from France. And these were teacher education colleges. They were called schools because they offered a three-year program instead of a four-year bachelor's degree. But the same idea. These were places that were created in reaction to not having access to the kinds of colleges that came before them.
Isn't it interesting, though, that many of the former agricultural schools and the former teacher schools are now full-fledged universities? Has there been some homogenization of what started with such great variety?
Oh, absolutely right. And you know, you've put your finger on it, and that is that the trend in higher education over time has been towards looking like a particular kind of thing. And that thing is usually residential, students living in or around the college. It has some degree of research occurring. And there is some emphasis on quality of the experience for undergraduate students. But that's right. Over time, they have changed. It's one of the reasons that I think most people today are unaware that some of our major universities in the United States, UCLA, Kent State, Arizona State University, all began as teachers' colleges, as normal schools. But through that institutional process, through that institutional transformation, those histories have sort of dissolved in people's minds.
Why is that? Why have colleges that started specialized merged more toward this sort of common picture, this common framework?
Right. No, it's a great question. It really has to do with institutions chasing the ideal institution of higher education. So normal schools wanting to become more respected, to have greater status in sort of the higher education marketplace, if you will. And so they wind up adopting programs that will allow them to look more like the high status places, like, let's say, Harvard University. And so the normal schools over time will move from a 3-year curriculum to a 4-year curriculum. So they become teachers' colleges instead of normal schools. And then they open their doors to students who want to do more than just teach or things other than teach. And so then they become state colleges. And then over time, they differentiate their academic programs and create new things that make them look like universities, so they become state universities. And so the example that I give in the book is something called the California State Normal School, which began in San Francisco and moved down to the city of San Jose and became the San Jose Normal School. Then it became San Jose Teachers College, then San Jose State College, essentially, and it is San Jose State University today.
You're careful not to be too critical of schools that have made decisions, even decisions that seem to be based on commercial concerns or the customer service mentality. And that's because I think you said colleges and universities are up against the ropes.
They are. It's true. You know, this is a very recent phenomenon in the history of American education, really only dates back the past 20 to 30 years. And if you think about how long the history of higher education is in the United States, that's fairly recent. Post-1970, colleges and universities went into a moment in which they found that their state subsidies, especially the public institutions, began to decline, that there was more demand that they do a better job preparing students for jobs, for the employment marketplace. And they began adopting a sort of corporate approach to operations. And when they did that, they got themselves into a little bit of an arms race. And then suddenly they were competing with each other directly in a way that they never had traditionally. So before the show, you and I were talking about the University of California, Berkeley, right? If you go back 50 years, the University of California, Berkeley, and let's say the University of Michigan were never in direct competition. They were regional universities that served a particular population in a particular area of the country. Now those places are actually in direct competition. And so they're forced to engage in the kind of corporate competitive practices that we see in the business world that really has not existed for the most part in American higher education. So a good example would be that if your college or university has a new fancy dorm, that might appeal to students. So now I need to build a new fancy dorm, or you have a new fancy fitness center and I need a new fancy fitness center. And the next thing you know, we're in an arms race around amenities and those sorts of things. And the more you move in that direction, the more you move in the direction of having to adopt this corporate model of competition. And that seems to be where we are today.
This is so interesting. We're speaking with Charles Dorn, the author of For the Common Good, A New History of Higher Education in America. We do have to take a break. When we come back, your comments and questions. Stay with us.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, we'll wrestle with some of the questions about free speech. Can opinions be too dangerous to allow on campus? Is violence at protests ever justified? And should protesters be allowed to carry weapons? 3 takes on political discord and protest, next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
And you can hear the New Yorker Radio Hour Saturday afternoon at 2 or Sunday evening at 11 on Maine Public Radio. Many businesses and organizations in and around Maine join listeners in supporting various public radio programs on Maine Public Radio. You hear their mentions every day. To learn how your business can benefit from supporting Maine Public Radio and Classical, Maine Public Television, or MainePublic.org, visit MainePublic.org. Click on About and then Business Support, or you can call us at 1-800-884-1717 and ask for Susan Tran. And of course, thank you for your support of public broadcasting here in Maine.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, what exactly is higher education good for? Joining me in the studio, Charles Dorn. He is an associate dean for academic affairs and professor of education at Bowdoin College. His new book is For the Common Good, A New History of Higher Education in America. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Before we go to the calls, though, I want to ask you, Professor Dorn, about the advent of college rankings, most famously the U.S. News and World Report. What has that done in your view? How has that changed or not changed higher education in America?
It's a great question. The rankings matter, right? People pay close attention to them, and for a number of different reasons. First of all, if you have a child who's interested in going to college and you want to start figuring out which college to go to, you know, the obvious question is, how do you do that? What's your first step? And for many people, the first step is to take a look at some form of rankings, and whether it's, you know, U.S. News and World Report or some other publications rankings, to get a handle on sort of what are the top tier places and what do they offer, and to sort of work your way through there. So the rankings do matter as a sort of, you know, reference guide. If we go back to what we were talking about just before the break, this sort of corporate competitive model that colleges and universities have adopted, this is one of the forms of direct competition that has really sort of been catalyzed or grown fairly quickly. The rankings are not new. The Chronicle of Higher Education back in the 60s began ranking institutions based on the Carnegie Foundation rankings, and this was again sort of a reference guide for most people. It wasn't a way for or a mechanism through which colleges or universities directly competed, but it certainly has become that now. If I have any advice for anyone who pays close attention to those rankings, I would advise them to keep in mind that this is, as a friend of mine says, you know, this is often about selling magazines or selling whatever publication that the rankings are published in, as much as it is about the rankings themselves.
And it's a system that can be gamed. One of the criteria, for example, is selectivity. So the more students the college or university can market to and get to apply, the better the selectivity ranking.
That's right. Yeah. So some of these are sort of clunky, right? If and it can certainly, you know, be gamed if you have more and more students applying, but you have a fairly fixed number of seats in terms of the admissions process, then it makes you look more competitive because your admissions rate goes down to, 16% or something like that. And for sure, we can imagine that there is a temptation that colleges and universities have to do that. The extent to which they do that, I actually have no idea. And I'm an optimist around these things and think that people try to, work in a fairly authentic way. But yeah.
We'll go to Pete, who's calling from Cherryfield. Hi, Pete. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm just loving what your guest has said and is saying. I've been in college counseling for 40 years, so I've seen it all. He absolutely is right that schools have morphed into a kind of corporate mode. But I am particularly concerned with rural, poor students who find themselves recruited for schools that they can't afford and that they're not prepared for, and that contribute to the $1 trillion in student debt that has financed many schools that basically should be out of business. I think we are doing a poor job in our schools counseling students about what I prefer to call post-secondary education or training. anyway, I'm going to get off the air because I'm going to go buy the book. I've been saying right on, right on, right on, one after the other as he made his point. So thank you, Professor.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. No, you've hit on a bunch of really great points there. So first of all, has to do, and I'll just sort of link it back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of we use the term higher education, but what are we actually talking about? Are we talking about community colleges? Are we talking about places that might better serve some students versus others? It's one of the real problems with the national dialogue we have around higher education today is we really don't specify sort of what we mean when we use the term. I think what you're talking about in terms of post-secondary education might be a more useful way to think about it. Look, we're not a situation in which it's really good news, and that more and more students have access to higher education in America than they ever have in the nation's history. That is really quite an amazing accomplishment, and it's good news for our country. As you increase the size of an institution the way that we have with higher education, undoubtedly, we're going to run into some challenges in terms of figuring out what is the best model for us to use. What's the best way to serve students coming from different backgrounds? And the point that you're making around rural backgrounds in particular is a good one. We have to be careful, though, that we make sure that we don't prematurely derail students from their goals or move them in particular directions that may conflict with what their hopes are. So we have this interesting experience with community colleges in the United States, right? The community college is the only real American invention in higher education. Everything else we borrowed from other areas of the world, particularly the Europeans. The agricultural colleges we borrowed from the Prussians, the normal schools from the French, the residential colleges from the English and the Scots. But the community college is the American invention, and it began as the junior college in the early 20th century. And the idea there was that students could take classes, enroll in a junior college. It was literally a junior college, so you would study there for 2 years, and then you would move on to a bachelor's degree to granting institution. Over time, the junior college morphed and transformed into something we call the community college. And whether the community colleges now are doing the same thing depends a lot on the college itself and the kind of counseling that students are receiving when they enroll in the community colleges based on their different goals and their aspirations. So we do need to pay particular attention to how we serve the students that we do serve and making sure that they have access to the kinds of institutions that will allow them to achieve their goals, not the goals that other people have set for them. I do want to mention one thing about debt, which this is an incredibly important topic in the United States today. And there are some things that we need to know about debt. First of all, the national conversation around debt in higher education is problematic because we usually mix together the costs of undergraduate education and the costs of professional education. And those in some ways are two different things. One might be willing, a student might be willing to take on $50,000, $100,000 in debt, if it's medical school, that will probably allow that person to pay that back somewhat quickly over time, in contrast with an undergraduate degree, which is a very different story. If we actually if we disaggregate that data a bit, what we find is that, the average debt for students coming out of an undergraduate degree is about $25,000. And if you take a look at the benefits over time for one's income, if you have a college degree versus not having a college degree, then for sure we know, hands down, that college is a good investment financially because that $25,000 is going to be paid back along with the cost of going to college, along with the opportunity cost associated with going to college. So we know that an undergraduate degree is still worth the investment in the United States today. Whether or not that will continue to be true over time is a different question.
Pete, thanks so much for your thoughtful call. We're going to move also to down East Maine to Bob calling from Eastport. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer and Dr. Dorn. Great program. I'd like to mention a couple things. One on rankings. Money Magazine picked Maine Maritime as the number one public school out of 1,400 in the United States, several years running. And Brookings Institution agreed, and the Atlantic Magazine did a great series. And it shows in the graduate rates that 90 days out, about 90% of the students have a job in their field. And the other issue is talking about public service. I'm just thinking, you're talking about it, that in Calais, Robinson, Perry, Eastport, Pembroke, Whiting, Cutler, Lubeck, there are selectmen and city councilors, select women, who are graduates of Maine Maritime in all of those towns in the past 10 years. So it's an important part of what you're taught at Maine Maritime is that you've got to give back. And what better way to be on the school board or the local government system? So that's something that's instilled into Maine Maritime. It's beaten into the kids, really. You are going to give back. So,
right.
Thank you.
Right. This is a really, Bob, it's a really terrific point, this sort of public service mission or the civic obligation that many of our colleges and universities suggest, if not outright say, that graduates should adopt. You know, this is the element of higher education's commitment to the common good. And if we go back to 1802, again, let's say to the inaugural address delivered by Joseph McKean at Bowdoin College. This was an interesting formulation. He said that Bowdoin College existed, and I'm just using Bowdoin as an example here, but Bowdoin College existed to prepare students to become ministers and members of what were called the learned professions. So this was law and medicine and teaching and statescraft. But then he said, but these literary institutions, the colleges and universities, actually don't exist just for that purpose. They exist for the common good, and that students who graduate from them have a peculiar obligation. And that's the language that he used. I really like it. He didn't just say they have an obligation to give back to society. He said they have a peculiar obligation, right? And so it opens up this conversation around why would one think that if one graduates from a college or university that, you know, that they're obliged to give back to society. That's not a no-brainer, so to speak. It's a peculiar idea, but it is essential in the history of American higher education. It is throughout the archives of our colleges and universities that have been established over 200 years that graduates do have some obligation to give back to society, that they have benefited from a higher education, which puts them in a particular spot, if you will, to give back to society. And as you're suggesting here, Maine Maritime is a great example of that. Certainly our other military academies are another very good example of that.
Bob, thank you so much for your call. Here's an email from Alan. Alan writes, I read a few years ago that income for college grads were about the same as those of their parents. When income rose, it was because students participated in extracurricular activities and partnered with their professors on research projects. In other words, making relationships and broadening their college experience. Is that true?
That's a really great question, and I don't have an answer to whether it is true or not. What I can tell you is that, getting back earlier to the conversation we were having about the arms race, there is a sort of upside to the arms race, if you will, and that is that colleges and universities, in order to compete with each other, have really had to sort of up their game in terms of the quality of the student experience. And some of that does have to do, some of it is just amenities, but some of it does have to do with the quality of the learning experience that is occurring on college and university campuses in the United States today. A good example of this would be students conducting research with faculty as undergraduates. Right, 50 years ago, research was the purview of faculty and graduate students. And in the United States today, in many of our colleges and universities, undergraduate students are now actively engaged in research with students. And it's a really rich opportunity for those students to come to understand the nature of the academic enterprise and scholarship, but also, as you're suggesting, sort of, you know, building these relations with faculty who are role models in many ways for these students. And so I'm not sure, you know, in terms of the tangible outcome relating to income and that sort of thing, what the relationship is there. But for sure, if you take a look at alumni surveys or graduating senior surveys from colleges and universities in the United States today, usually one of the most important things that they will note as contributing to their college education, the 4 years or 5 years or 6 years that they were in college, had to do with the relationships that they formed with faculty members. It's a very important part of what's happening on campuses today.
We're discussing the role of higher education with Charles Dorn, the author of the new book, For the Common Good. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number 1-800-399-3566. We do have to take another quick break. This is Maine Calling.
When your sister is your co-founder, things can get a little complicated.
One of the things that we started a couple of years ago is the idea of corporate couples counseling.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. New York Fashion Week, it's a Minkoff family affair. That's next time on Marketplace.
And join us for Marketplace this evening at 6:30.
On the next Fresh Air.
So many friends from college have become successful.
The new film Brad Status stars Ben Stiller as someone overcome by corrosive jealousy of old college friends who are more successful than he is. I'll talk with the film's writer and director, Mike White, who also wrote the film School of Rock and created the HBO series Enlightened. Join us.
And join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. And join us at 2 o'clock following Maine Calling for the Commonwealth Club of California. Today's speaker is evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins. He'll challenge faulty logic, bad science, and climate change deniers. That's the Commonwealth Club of California coming up after Maine Calling here on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the value of a college education and the role of universities and colleges in fostering the common good. In the studio with me, Charles Dorn, Associate Dean for Academic Affairs and Professor of Education at Bowdoin College. He's also the author of the new book, For the Common Good, A New History of Higher Education in America. If you'd like to join the conversation, a phone number, 1-800-399-3566. While we were on the air, our producer slipped us a new article that was on the Wall Street Journal today. Americans are losing faith in the value of a college degree, it says. 49% of Americans believe earning a four-year degree will lead to a good job and higher lifetime earnings, just a slim margin higher than those who don't believe it's worth it, even though, as you said, Professor Dorn, the statistics say otherwise. What is behind the skepticism, and is this a new thing?
Right. So there are a couple of things behind the skepticism, but it's certainly not a new thing. And a good example of it not being a new thing is this. In the year 1900, the Saturday Evening Post, which was really one of the most widely subscribed magazines in the United States at the time, published a cover story. And the question right on the cover of the Saturday Evening Post was, does a college education pay? So this is not a new question. At the time, the editor of the Saturday Evening Post, wanting to make a sort of big deal out of what was an important question of the time, actually had former U.S. President Grover Cleveland respond. He was not a college graduate himself, but his response was, well, of course it pays, and here are the reasons why. The reason that question was being asked in the year 1900, and I think the reason that people are developing some sort of, in some ways, healthy skepticism around it in the year 2017 are very similar, and that is that the cost of education is increasing. College and university higher education is increasing. Tuition costs are on the rise. This question around relevance, what do you really get out of it, is with us. And these questions become particularly prominent at moments of instability in American history. So in the year 1900, we had a couple of somewhat familiar things happening. The country was just recovering from a major recession. The United States had engaged in what was essentially a war that was declared over fairly quickly, but then continued on over a long period of time. It was a time of dramatic increases in immigration, and there were a sort of unsettled times and social unrest. And so you have this sort of unsettled society, And you have this axial institution, higher education, which is supposed to be sort of the rock-solid ivory tower. And these two things come into conflict, and people start wondering, well, what is the point of this higher education thing? So there are lots of different factors that go into these moments in time of questioning and criticism of higher education. I think the important point to make here, though, is that higher education has been remarkably resilient over time. Again, going back to sort of the ivory tower metaphor, in many ways, there's not even the slightest truth about colleges and universities being ivory towers. They have over time been very resilient, very responsive to societal needs. And for that reason, they've actually been remarkably successful. I mean, if you think today about let's say major companies that existed in the United States 200 years ago, it's a little hard to name one. If you think about colleges and universities that existed in the United States 200 years ago, we can actually do that quite quickly. And so, you know, how do you explain the resilience of these institutions? It has to actually to do with their flexibility, which is really the opposite of this phrase ivory tower that we've used.
Interesting point. Yeah. We have an email from Daniel. I'm curious if your guest will comment on the phenomena of certain universities and colleges amassing billion-dollar endowment funds. What does that say about college today?
Yeah, so the endowments are very controversial and they're very complicated. Here's my take on endowments. An endowment is a mechanism for an institution of higher education to provide, to subsidize essentially the education that students are receiving. And if the institution is really managing its endowment well, then what it's able to do is to provide financial support to students to attend the college or the university in a way that they might not be able to if they didn't receive that financial support. So, you know, I would say this, if you have a $1 billion endowment and most of the draw for the endowment is going to something that is non-educational, then you have a problem. But if it's going to, let's say, financial aid to support students who might not otherwise be able to afford to go to that institution, then that seems to me a pretty, you know, reasonable thing to do.
We'll go to Rick, who's calling from Lincolnville. Hi, Rick. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you? Thank you. And I know your time is limited, and I haven't heard the whole program, so I don't want to be redundant with respect to things already covered. One thing I feel very strongly about, my wife and I met and had the privilege to attend a traditional, I guess you would say, brick-and-mortar school, a very old school in Williamsburg, Virginia. And for us, that preparation and what we were able, fortunately, to give our children as well had less to do with an occupation. I'm a retiree now. Less to do with an occupation, much more to do with the ability to be good both U.S. and world citizens. And by that, I mean the ability, particularly in troubled times, to thoughtfully analyze problems, to have a perspective on one's neighbors, their viewpoints, to be able to sort through sometimes very difficult options, to understand other fields and other professions, and generally to be able maturely to work through not only world problems, but news of all kinds, which is more and more polarized, and in effect to be good citizens, which is, I think, very important, quite apart from some responsibility toward the common good.
Thank you, Rick.
Right, Rick, this is central to the book and really is the thing that I was focused on when I began the research. And this is the common good piece in terms of civic engagement and how does education prepare us to be good citizens. And that is a theme that we can easily trace throughout the history of American higher education. Here's the tricky part, and Jennifer referred to it earlier. It's pretty easy to measure whether or not our graduates have a job within 6 months following graduation or not. It's pretty easy to figure out sort of how much they're making in their jobs a year after graduation. It's much more difficult to figure out whether or not they're being good citizens. And we have a tendency to sort of, you know, care about what we can measure instead of measuring, right, the things that we care about that we can't measure well winds up sort of shifting our focus so that we wind up caring about what we can measure. And I would say really in higher education today, we should be paying much closer attention to those things that we care about that are much more difficult to measure. Things like our colleges and universities preparing students to be good citizens in a democratic society where they can critically analyze an argument, use evidence to draw conclusions, and those sorts of really important parts of being an informed citizen in America.
Rick, thanks for your call. We'll move to George calling from Augusta. Hi, George. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
No, good afternoon. Thank you for having me. I kind of feel the same way like a lot of folks. Is it worth it, et cetera? But I guess I'm kind of curious, is this a phenomenon that is just peculiar to the U.S.? You know, is there the same sort of angst in Europe and Asia? Or do they also feel the same way we do?
Great, great question. So, you know, the United States has a somewhat unique higher education system in comparison to other places, particularly in Europe and, let's say, in Asia. We have this sort of mass public system of higher education, and we've had it in place now for decades, and it has done a very good job, historically speaking, of providing a lot of people quality higher education. Whether or not it will continue to do that into the future is a totally different question. But in comparison to, let's say, the European nations, where there has been much more attention to limiting access, in the United States we have had, and I'm speaking historically here, in the United States we've had essentially a history of expanding access. And so, yes, there are concerns in other nations today that higher education may be too costly in relation to sort of the returns you get on the investment. Certainly, we see those conversations happening in England and in Germany in particular. But it is a different kind of conversation given the sort of mass higher education system we have in the United States.
George, thanks for your call. And I don't want to end the hour without asking you about another big trend in higher education, Professor Dorn, which is online education, online classes. If you're writing this book 10 or 20 years from now, are we talking about an entirely different system?
That's a great question. So the jury's out on what's going to happen with online education. What we think we see happening is that it is being sort of brought into the mainstream as a part of what's happening in colleges and universities. So we have especially our large public universities embracing online education as an element of the curricular programming that they offer, but just one element. And I think that's probably the direction that we're going. We know that many of the online for-profit operations that have been in existence over the past 20 years are problematic in all sorts of ways. Student debt coming out of those places is much higher than the average debt. Employment prospects are actually lower, so the bang for your buck is not there. Many of the online for-profit companies really have 80% of their revenues coming from publicly subsidized loans. So it's not clear what's going to happen in the future, but for sure that's going to be an important element of what we see happening in higher ed.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Charles Dorn, excuse me, Associate Dean for Academic Affairs and Professor of Education at Bowdoin College. His new book is For the Common Good, A New History of Higher Education in America. John Keimel ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling and our audio archives at mainecalling.net. Today's show will be rebroadcast tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, join me for a conversation about student athletes and sports medicine, especially the new trend to have kids specialize in one sport early. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.